This talk is brought to you by the Thomistic Institute. For more talks like this, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I approach the question when is war justified from a kind of different perspective than maybe is typical. Although what I'll be teaching you is certainly the Catholic view, in my judgment at least. My approach to this is to begin by talking about broader questions of governance, because I think too often the question about war in the Catholic perspective focuses on a very narrow conception of the just war approach as a kind of theory, which I think actually turns out to be quite misleading. We all are aware of the theory. I'm sure all of you are familiar with these categories. You've read them, you've read about them before, you've heard about them. The first category, sometimes called the right to go to war, the jus ad bellum, has these three criteria associated with it: right authority, right intentionality, or right intention, and just cause. And then there's a second category, the category of the jus in bello, or the way that you should be fighting in the context of war. And that has two criteria of its own: discrimination, or called the principle of distinction in international law, and proportionality. And the standard approach to these things, think of this as a kind of checklist. You know, you go up and down the list, making sure that everything falls into accord with it, and maybe do a kind of after the fact judgment of a conflict or, you know, a war, or you do a prior evaluation of a conflict or the war and make a determination about this. But this is, I think, again, a kind of misleading way of understanding things. And even the language, which I put in quotation marks, of just war or just war theory, are themselves misleading. Just war can sometimes lead people to think there's a kind of convergence of the term with holy war, right? That this is now a righteous war. And the language of jus, you know, which is the language from which we get notions of right in the Christian tradition, can suggest that notion of a kind of righteous war. But again, I think this is misleading. I think the most important way to think about these things is in terms of politics, and in particular, in terms of the Catholic approach to war as not a list, not an exception-making instrument, which is what this way of it can sometimes seem. Some people will understand this approach to be about making exceptions. Okay, so we know that we're not supposed to behave in certain ways, generally speaking, but now some massive conflict faces us and we ask ourselves question, is the conflict and maybe the morality associated with the conflict worth departing from our typical ways of behaving for the sake of some great good? This is, I think, a false way of understanding things. In my view, the just war approach to the ethics of force in the Catholic tradition is best seen as an instrument of peacemaking. Okay, what we're describing here is an instrument of peacemaking, not an what we are called to be as Christians, the kinds of commandments we're called to follow that Christ specifies in the Beatitudes, where he asks his followers to be peacemakers. It's not an exception to the prohibition on murder. Instead, it's a kind of specification or description of how political authority should be thinking about ordering force for the sake of common good. Okay, so part of what we're talking about here is different conceptions of politics, right, and governance. And within the Christian tradition, as you all are aware, there are different approaches to thinking about the relationship of Christians, believers, followers of Christ to the state. Right? And the state is often understood in the tradition as the bearer of the sword. So some of you may be familiar with this passage. It's famous Article 6 of something called the Schleitheim Confession from 1527. And if you remember your history well, you'll understand that this is in the midst of the Reformation, right? The Protestant Reformations on the continent. And Schleitheim is a group that eventually becomes a sort of Anabaptist or Mennonite traditions, the Amish tradition in the United States. And their approach to this, of course, is a renunciation of the sword. They will have nothing to do with bearing the sword. But what you see, which I find fascinating about this Article 6, is that they understand the sword is a righteous instrument of the state, okay? But it's outside of the perfection of Christ, as they put it, right? It's not for them to wield, but nonetheless, God has given the sword to civil authority, to political authority. And as it says here, for the punishment of the wicked and for their death, right? So it actually serves a purpose from even their perspective, but they are not to be those who are involved in its use, okay? So this is one approach, right, from within the Christian communion to thinking about the problem of force and also how Christians themselves ought to relate to it. Another model, which has roots in the same Reformation, is one, you know, like we have a particular version of it in the United States, right? And this is a kind of deep separation between the church and the state. So it actually shares something in common with the Schleitheim approach. It shares this idea that there ought to be some kind of separation between churches and the state, right? And the state will be involved in certain kinds of activity and the churches in other kinds of activity. But whereas the followers of the Schleitheim Confession, right, the Anabaptists, for instance, understood themselves to always be living on one side of the wall, right? The side of the wall where faith is. This approach asks individual Christians to make a kind of duality in their own lives, right? To recognize that sometimes they'll be living as Christians, you know, and that'll be their private worship, their beliefs, perhaps their schooling in some respects, they have private schools, but other times to live as members of the state. So as politicians, perhaps in public schools, you know, perhaps even as soldiers for our purposes, right? That you can bifurcate your life where this approach recognizes a bifurcation within society, right? Two kinds of societies that are gonna live side by side, right? Not intermingled. This approach imagines the bifurcation that involves a kind of intermingling. Right, we will be mixed in with the non-Christians, but we will bifurcate our lives ourselves. We'll do that for ourselves, okay? And we will sometimes bear the sword, right? We will be willing to bear the sword on behalf of the state. So much of this approach, this sort of dualistic approach, traces to St. Augustine. And this is this conception, as you know, of the two cities, right? Or the city of God and the earthly city. And Augustine describes this, right, as there being these two communities that are formed around love, right? It's objects of love that will form these communities. And the one community, the city of God, is that community that forms itself around love of God. The other community, the earthly community, is the one that forms itself around love of self. And for Augustine, at least as it's described in the City of God in particular moments, these are mutually incompatible, right? These communities are incompatible. They're exclusive of each other. But it doesn't solve the problem of how they relate to each other, okay? So there is a kind of fundamental exclusion of each other in terms of their objects of love. But how they actually relate to each other in the world is where it gets very fascinating, right? And he says this, continuing, that the city of God, the heavenly city, will in fact pull people who are citizens of all the nations into itself, right? And gather them all together as pilgrims. And it does this respectful of their different languages, their different cultures, their different laws. And all of these people who are now in this community, this city of God, who are joined by this love, don't annul, right? Do not abolish the cultures, the languages, the laws of the places of which they are part, right? They, in essence, understand them better than their fellow citizens who are not in the city of God will understand them, but they don't nullify them. They don't extinguish them. They don't abolish them. They somehow sort of coordinate their lives around them and within them. And one of the most famous passages of Augustine's in the City of God is this famous passage where he talks about judging and judgment. And in my opinion, this is a very like a paradigmatic statement of how the Christian understands him or herself to be involved in the activities of the world. Augustine, rather famously, as I'm sure you guys all understand, has a deep understanding of the effect of sin on human community and how sin is transmitted from person to person. You know, it's transmitted generationally, and how it affects the lived experiences of communities. I'm going to read this in whole because I find it to be a beautiful and disturbing passage in many ways. But it's really, really powerful and important for us as Christians, more or less, to wrap our heads around and try to figure out to what extent we get what he's saying here. So he writes, "What shall I say of these judgments which men pronounce upon men and which are necessary in communities, whatever outward peace they enjoy?" And these are the judgments that men and women now will make as judges, right? Melancholy and lamentable judgments they are, since the judges are men who cannot discern the consciences of those at their bar, and are therefore frequently compelled to put innocent witnesses to the torture to ascertain the truth regarding the crimes of other men. Thus, the ignorance of the judge frequently involves an innocent person in suffering, and what is more unendurable, a thing indeed to be bewailed, and if that were possible, watered with fountains of tears, is this, that when the judge puts the accused to the question, that he may not unwittingly put an innocent man to death. The result of this lamentable ignorance is that this very person whom he tortured that he might not condemn him if innocent is condemned to death both tortured and innocent. If such darkness shrouds social life, will a wise judge take his seat on the bench or no? Beyond question, Augustine answers, he will. For human society, which he thinks it a wickedness to abandon, constrains him and compels him to this duty. So, like I said, this is a kind of stark and powerful passage, right? And you see him talking about torture and innocence. I don't think we should be misled by the language of torture and innocence and the incapacity of the judge to know the conscience of the persons he's inquiring about, right? This is a problem that remains with anybody in judgment. And Augustine describes this quandary into which those of us who want to engage the world as judges or as perhaps soldiers, right? As politicians, as lawyers, as, you know, in any sort of worldly aspect, these are the things that we face. He's describing that. These are the kinds of problems that we face in obviously typically not so extreme ways, but it's very important that he draws it to its extreme. And in these situations, he asks, if there's such darkness that encompasses our social lives, should a Christian, should a wise man, that's what he means by a wise man, should a Christian sit on the bench? And his answer is, yes, absolutely, right? And as he says, for human society, he thinks a wickedness to abandon. It constrains him and it compels him to this duty. And this is a kind of image from a monograph of the judge, you know, sitting, in judgment of someone before him, who's brought, you know, clearly coerced, right? Brought by force before him. This is, an enormous problem. But part of his point, of course, is summed in this statement of his, which is quite famous, as there is a commingling of these two cities. They are intermingled, okay, right? We really don't know who's in the city of God and who's outside of the city of God. But what we do know is that even those who are members of the city of God, as he says here, also enjoy the peace of Babylon. They too make use of the peace of the earthly city, and that they make use of it, right? They can benefit from it is of great importance. They now have a kind of responsibility towards it, right? Much like the responsibility we just saw him embracing in the language of the judge, okay? But what we know, of course, is that when Augustine thinks about these questions, right? He thinks about them in the context of certain variables that are important from our faith. One is, as we've described, right, the effect of sin on the world that we inhabit, right? So he's very descriptive about the way sin colors social life. There's no, sort of false aspirations in Augustine's explanation of what cities will look like, what nation states will look like in the world. Instead, they will be marked by the effects of sin. They will be marked by suffering. They will be marked by ignorance and pain. And another consequence of this, of course, another variable of this is that they will be marked by war. War, he describes as a great evil, and he describes it very descriptively as one involving enormous sufferings. Even wars that he calls, that he will refer to as just wars, he understands them to involve great sufferings. Yet another variable is that when he describes our obligations to enter into society, our obligations to take our seat at the bench and to sit in judgment, he describes them as also framed by the moral law, right? And one aspect of the moral law is the one that's in front of us on this slide, right? Which is, this is from the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Deliberate murder of an innocent person is gravely contrary to the dignity of a human being, to the golden rule, and to the holiness of the Creator, right? So it is always wrong to take innocent life. It's always contrary to the church's moral teaching, to the moral teaching of the natural law, right? So it's not merely contrary to the church's moral teaching. It's contrary to the word of God, to the gospel. So all of these things will frame this Catholic perspective on thinking about how to use force, how to involve oneself in force. The Catechism continues then in a way that I think actually derives to some extent from Augustine by saying the killing that we understand to be a part of war, right? The killing that occurs in legitimate defense, which is an important category itself, the killing that occurs in legitimate defense is not an exception to the prohibition they outline in 2261, right? That we've seen right here, right? So somehow, we're understanding that this killing is actually expressive, possibly expressive of the kind of love that we're supposed to have for others. It's not an exception. And this is a point that Pope John Paul II made in his own writings, where he said, the prohibition against killing does not sort of sum up the gospel of life to which we are called, right? The kind of love to which we are called. That sometimes the love to which we are called requires us to act out of defense of those who are threatened. And in those situations, acting in defense of those who are threatened against the threats posed to them can be a kind of positive aspect of the expression of love, as hard as that, you know, can sometimes seem. So the entire, in my judgment, The entire apparatus of the just war theory, that's the JWT there, right? The entire framework of the just war theory that we saw in the very, you know, maybe it was the second or third slide that I posted that describes the two categories, jus ad bellum and the jus in bello, and their criteria really derives from these kinds of presuppositions that we're now discussing, right? First is that Christians share in, make use of, and have obligations toward the peace of their city, right? We benefit from this peace, much as even the Schleitheim Confession acknowledges, right, that the sword actually does punish transgressors, right? So the sword of the state, right, the use of force is actually done on behalf of right judgment, right? Right judgment. And it's done, in other words, by those who possess the authority to make these judgments. And those who possess the authority, right, come under this criterion of right authority. This is not a judgment for me to make. It's not a judgment for private individuals to make. It is for those who have responsibility for the common good. When those who have responsibility for the common good judge, they do so on behalf of the common good. What derives from those good judgments on behalf of the common good become normative for all of the citizens of the community of which they are a part. And then it's their responsibility to act out on behalf of those things. Okay, so that's right authority, right? Right authority limits those who can exercise this power of judgment, right? This responsibility of judgment of the sort that we saw Augustine writing about, right? This grave responsibility. And in that responsibility, thereby bind the action of other members of the community towards the judgment as they've seen it. In addition, all action, like I said, has to be ordered towards the common good, right? It has to be ordered towards this good, components of which are justice, right? That they must be, in fact, right action, and peace, ultimately. And this is embraced in the criterion of right intention. Right intention in the theory, in the, you know, the just war way of thinking in this framework or apparatus, is the principle that orders all political action towards this good end, towards the common good, even towards a common good that is not static, right, but that is actually open to the possibility that it's inclusive of all those who stand judged by the initial judgment. So it includes not merely those who are defended by the act of force, but it also includes those who are acting, right, against those who are defended. It includes what we might just call for shorthand the enemy, right? All of those people are members of a moral community from this perspective towards which this political act must be directing itself. Just like when we punish someone, right, when the domestic law, the civil law punishes an individual, it does so on behalf of the community, but it also does so with some regard for the good of he or her who is punished, him or her who is punished by the state. Thus, following all of this, the morality that binds us must be the same morality. Okay, there is no departure in this approach from the morality that binds us in our private lives. Right, we cannot think that the good can be served by departing from the moral law, and this is a huge issue. In sort of technical just war analysis, you may have seen essays recently on the anniversary of the bombings by the United States of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where people were appealing to the just war account, some to argue against those bombings and some to argue in favor of those bombings, right? In defense of those bombings. I am one of those who argues against them, arguing that departure from morality, right, the intentional decision to kill innocent people is immoral, and it cannot therefore be made a right intention, right? It cannot actually serve the end of peace as we understand it, because it's a violation of the moral law. But we can discuss that a little bit more perhaps at the end of this. So the distinction between guilt and innocent is crucial to this account, right, as I just said. And it's crucial to the notion of just cause, right? Ultimately, the precipitating cause for any conflict is determined precisely in terms of who is responsible for what is happening. Is there a wrong done, right? And that's critical. If there's no wrong done, then you can't sort of prosecute a conflict, right? You can't move towards a war, right? So you have to name it, and you have to be able to describe it in a way that is susceptible to rejection, right? Where people can say, no, you're wrong in this judgment about what in fact is the cause. There will always be dispute about just cause. That's endemic to sinful humanity, to a conflict of human wills, right, about what is good. But that does not mean that there is not in fact an apt judgment, a right judgment to be made here. So just cause is also critical to and derives from these presuppositions we've been discussing. All of this amounts to saying that from within our tradition, from within the Catholic tradition for thinking about justice in conflict, right, justice in war, killing is therefore distinguishable from murder, right? And it's distinguishable from murder in terms of an apt judgment about some wrong that's been committed, right? Some threat that is now being prosecuted against some victim of that threat. And this means that it's therefore orderable towards peace when one intervenes on behalf of the victim. this is non-murderous killing in these contexts, authorized for the sake of the good of the political community that may be threatened, and also for the good of those who pose the threat. Thus, you know, morality in the conflict must be must abide the laws, you know, or must be the same morality as is, you know, sort of shared prior to the conflict itself.
I just wanted to ask you about the right authority. So yes. Who do you think has the right authority to actually carry out any of these actions?
So it's a great question, right? Because this is an issue that's deeply contested in our time. And states often claim for themselves this right, right? So we know the conflict or the controversy right now is between states, especially like the United States, right? States that have the capacity and the power to make these judgments will claim it for themselves. The United States will claim we alone have the authority to make these kinds of judgments and the authority, therefore, to carry out and prosecute this kind of activity. The other contestant to this is international law, right? International law and international community deeply specifies conditions under which contemporary conflict or use of force will be justified. And it calls into question the rights of states to make these judgments on their own. This is something that is, it's a moving issue. It's a growing issue. So within the tradition, it understands that this authority can rest in different places. It's rested in kings, it's rested in dukes, it's rested in emperors. Now it's rested in presidents and prime ministers, and it rests to some extent in the Security Council of the United Nations. These are moving questions. Pope Francis spoke to this issue a bit just 2 weeks ago in Fratelli Tutti, when he also sort of leaned the tradition into the international law posture with regard to this question. So great question. It's contested. Part of what's clear is it's in opposition to private justifications for killing, like vendetta type situations when families or tribes would act out of their own conceptions of what was right or good based on action against them. It was a kind of codifying of those who actually have responsibility for the common good and therefore could act in these ways.
In the case of, let's say, the person that does have the authority decides not to use it for a just cause, sure. Is it okay then for somebody else who is willing to fight for that justice, so to say, to kind of take that authority and then go and actually try and, you know, get that justice? Or is it because that they don't have the right authority, they can't do anything about it?
Yeah, so for great question. Okay, so there's at least two answers to this. The short answer is yes, if they do not possess the authority, they cannot vindicate their claim about being unjustly treated or what have you. So if you could think about some sort of local issue, right? I mean, this happens all the time, right? Where there's been a wrong done, maybe a family believes they were somehow wronged by some other family, or a person feels she was wronged by the community. And for whatever reason, the public authorities say, we are gonna take a pass on this, right? Where, you know, we've judged the situation such that we're just going to take a pass on it. Unfortunately, according to this account and according to our theology, we understand that not all justice will be given to us on earth, right? As a citizen of the city of God, you know that ultimately justice will be done, but it will not always be done, you know, on our schedule, right? So this opens up that gap between your justice being vindicated and it not being vindicated, right? So that was the quick response, and it took me a little while. I apologize, everybody. A longer answer is, this is also itself part of the controversy, part of the disagreement that I was talking about before, right? So if you think of international relationships, there will be times, and there have been times in the recent past, where a state will say, wait a minute, look at this grave injustice that's been done against either this other state or against themselves. and they'll go to the international community and they'll say, grave injustice, this needs to be reversed, right? And the international community will say, either you don't see it right, right? You know, you're wrong, it's not a grave injustice, or yeah, we get it, it's a grave injustice, but the consequences of responding to it are so large that we're just gonna have to, you know, we're gonna have to require everybody to stand down, you know, as unfortunate as it is, everybody's gonna have to stand down. Well, sometimes states, again, if they have the power, will exercise their sovereignty and say, well, forget you, right? Forget the international community. I mean, the United States does this, right? I mean, we're good at this, or bad at it, depending on your perspective. We have the authority to judge in our own case here. We bear the burden anyway of this kind of military action. We'll just do it. We came to you in good faith. You made the wrong judgment. Now we're going to prosecute it on our own. Actually, that turned out to be the shorter response.
Excellent. For a Catholic attempting to participate in the City of God and also the City of Earth, if we can know with fair certainty that our politicians or generals or maybe other leaders don't possess this right intention or right judgment and make decisions that aren't always ordered towards this ideal peace, what would the justification towards being in the military perhaps be? Personally, this is an important question for me. I'm in RTC. I wish to be a military chaplain, which in grim terms is a force multiplier. So how do I guess, what is the framework or best framework for understanding this? How can I trust that the U.S. government has this right to rule and uses that with prudence?
That's a great question, right? The posture of our tradition, and this may not surprise you, at least in its classic formulation, was very deferential to political authority. So people like Vittoria asked this question very clearly. The great Spanish theologian, scholastic theologian Vittoria in the 16th century asked the question you're asking right now, a version of it, right? And a version that's obviously infected by being a 16th century version of it. When the individual is confronted with a situation where they are skeptical about the claims made for them by political authority, those in authority, what are they to do? And his response was very deferential to political authority. You basically do what you're supposed to do. You know, you do what you're told to do, unless your knowledge of the situation was so clear. You knew with a kind of certitude they were wrong, right? So you had to bear the burden as the individual of knowing that what they were judging in the name of peace, what they were judging as a wrong and so on was mistaken, okay? Otherwise, you had to sort of, you know, toe the line, right? And as a ROTC member, right, you volunteered for this. So you've, in essence, you know, you've kind of adopted a posture of deference to the authority of those, right, who are your military commanders. You've not been forced into the situation. So you have already sort of moved yourself into this posture. And it would seem like a conclusion of this would be, well, you need to follow that posture until, again, you have a clear, the language we would use now, which Vittoria did not use, is clear conscience, that in fact your judgment is the correct judgment and their judgment is the wrong one. So merely to get to the practicality of it, merely to think they're wrong is not enough, right? At least in the classical understanding of this. And I think even still, you know, nobody would ever say you should act against your conscience here, but your conscience needs to be grounded, right? You need to be convicted that in fact they are mistaken.
Just when you were talking about sometimes not carrying out justice in the name of greater good, so for example, thinking that if justice was to be carried out, it would cost too much. I was just thinking back to World War II, when a lot of people weren't willing to kind of stand up against Hitler when he was taking over other countries. And I believe that was the reason why, because they thought if they'd let him off with a little bit, he just stopped there. But then he kept pushing, and that actually did result in, you know, a lot of bad. So do you think they were right in letting him kind of do his thing? Whereas if at the beginning they would have said, right, you're crossing the line now because you're taking over other countries, we will intervene now rather than intervening later.
Yeah, great follow-up question, Kinga. So I think there could be a distinction between the kinds of questions you're asking, right? So the first question, or the way I answered your question the first time, was along the lines of, sometimes we understand that punishment or response to an injustice is going to carry with it some grave consequences that might in fact be disproportionate, too large for the sake of the pursuit of justice, right? And so we just have to stand down. We have to just sort of, allow the injustice to stand, unfortunately, right? That's one kind of situation. Another kind of situation is what you're describing, I think, and I want to be fair to your question, in this second version, right, where during the Second World War, right, political leaders, right, the Prime Minister of England, other political leaders in Austria and so on, were faced with a question about, okay, what is the best way to stop Hitler, right? What is the best way to do this, right? And as you know, the term, right, that became the term, this sort of applied to Chamberlain, right? And the response was a term of appeasement. Let's just let it go, right? We will appease him. This was a mode, they thought, of giving the man what he wanted in order that he would not move any further, right? That he would then be pleased, appeased, satisfied with what he had. That, of course, proved to be, prudentially an enormous error, right? I can see how these kinds of responses are related, right? That sometimes if the injustice, is ongoing, right? Or you have a concern that it might be ongoing, that to let it stand becomes a form of appeasement. And I think that maybe that's the force of your question. But I, to your credit, I was thinking of a situation where something had been done and wasn't necessarily ongoing. And then that, because again, these things happen all the time. I'm sure in Ireland, this happens all the time. Guys are let out of jail like they are in the States. They may have stolen something. They may have done something that's, contrary to the law. And the state just decides, look, it's overwhelmed by, by numbers of prisoners, or it's overwhelmed, by legal cases. And they just have to let people go. And you just understand, like, look, not every case can be prosecuted. Not every criminal punished, and that's the nature of a finite world. That's the nature of a world where there is sin. But your second version of it is a powerful question. And clearly, Chamberlain was wrong, and other, European leaders who were of the same position, right? They were obviously wrong in their judgment about Hitler's willingness to prosecute a war.
I understand that a sword should be used to kind of warn people to not do wrong you and to sort of nudge them in the other direction. But what happens if you use the sword to warn people and then they say, oh yeah, I agree, and then they never repent, they never reform themselves, and then eventually they never believe you when they say, oh, we use the sword against you if you do wrong you, because it has no credibility anymore. How do you reconcile that with that struggle?
So part of what you're asking about shows like the really challenging way in which the authority, right, the right authority, the political authority, their action is justified first in terms of the common good, right? It's, or put differently, first in terms of the community, right? So if a man threatens the community by some action, the job of the sword, right, which basically means, right, the coercive power of the state, right? The job of the coercive power of the state or a political authority is to protect the community against that person. Sometimes it can protect people by just threatening. If you don't stop it, we're going to harm you. We're going to harm you by, incarcerating you. We're going to harm you by taking taking rights away from you, right? And, you know, sometimes in the United States, we're going to harm you by killing you, right? But sometimes it's just a threat, right? In order to stop them. Sometimes it's more than a threat, right? Sometimes it'll be the incarceration, right? Or the denial of rights, you know, even the right to life and so on, right? So you're right. It won't ever just be the threat, but the state's primary concern, the primary concern of the public authority is not necessarily the person, it's the community. And there will be plenty of times, and we know this from literature and movies and from history, where people are not reformed. They don't repent, as you said. And in essence, that's irrelevant to the state's pursuit of justice. The state, its pursuit of justice is in terms of the community. And if it can do this in a manner that also brings the individual to his or her reform, right, and even a kind of full Christian reform involving repentance, fantastic. But if it can't, that's also part of the nature of human sinfulness and finitude. Not all justice can be done now, including the justice that would come from the reform of an individual.
So this is quite a particular question, and it may not be. I want to tread lightly here, so if I come across as being flippant in the way I phrase this question, I really don't intend that. But
an Irishman being flippant, I'm not.
So the concept of just war, and even of just self-defense, from my limited knowledge, I'm no patristic scholar, but doesn't seem to pop up until St. Augustine. And St. Augustine has a quite sort of, shall we say, novel interpretation of the cleansing of the temple, where he treats it that our Lord actually used the whip of cords to whip the people out of the temple physically rather than just using it as a threat, which doesn't seem to be present in any of the previous church fathers' interpretations of that passage. So my question is this, and of course, you know, he's a father and a doctor and a saint, but is that not, you know, a departure from the apostolic tradition and the tradition that was passed on through the fathers up to that point? Is that not, you know, a novel departure into a different view on just self-defense and just
yeah, war? Yeah. That's a fantastic question, Matthias. And it's a question, as you may know, right, that's been dealt with from different angles by many, many different scholars, you know, for centuries, really, at this point. There is a case that it's a departure. When we say departure, you mean more than that. You mean it's, you know, not merely departure, it's a kind of, a reversal of, or, you know, even an abuse of, you know, an older patristic or apostolic tradition. So there are people who make that argument, as is well known. What many of them will say is something along the lines of, from Augustine forward, you have a kind of Christendom model of the morality or ethics of Christianity. And that model is a model of a kind of apostatizing, even, right, of the genuine Christian ethic that you find in the older community, you know, and again the apostolic community, and they'll point to the kinds of arguments you made. They'll point to you know, scripture and, you know, the Acts of the Apostles for evidence that seems to indicate that this was a peaceful community, and peaceful in the sense of a community largely unwilling to support the empire and to support the coercive powers of whatever communities they found themselves in, right? So there is that kind of argument for sure. And people, some of these people, colleagues of mine even, will argue that we're returning to this now, right? This is a slow, what we're experiencing now is a slow return, even within Catholicism, to this posture, right? So Francis's recent statements in Fratelli Tutti might be themselves part of this trend back to it, because we now occupy a post-Christendom situation, right? So Christians are going to find themselves excluded from certain kinds of state activity and maybe even renouncing some of it. So there is that kind of argument for sure. It won't be any surprise, since you couched your question in terms of, you know, worrying about being rude or whatever, that I am not of that view, right? I think there's both evidence in the earlier tradition, both of Christians who clearly were soldiers, right, and who were not, who were embraced as soldiers by the Christian community, were not, you know, told to renounce their professions, renounce their activities. And then I would be among those who argue something like, once the Christian community does become involved differently in the state, which is clear, I mean, that's just a fact, right? To the credit of those on the other side of this question, that they pointed this out, once they became more involved in the state, and the state, of course, you know, political authority, you know, famously converts, they now have a different responsibility. They have a different, you know, set of reflections on the way they're to engage the world that cannot depart from the same moral norms, right? But now will be expressed in different ways. But your question, it's a great one. I don't know if you've read Fratelli Tutti or not, right? Or if you read my essay on Fratelli Tutti, which I just published recently, the short essay, you'll see that Pope Francis, in this kind of strange footnote, basically says we're done with the Augustinian thing, right? I don't know if you've seen this or not, but some of you may have. You should definitely look at it. I think it's footnote 241 or two. And it's strange because it's just unexplained and also seems like a problem when you're considering this is not just Augustine. This is also the entire tradition post-Augustine, at least Western tradition, right? Not the Orthodox Christian tradition, but certainly Aquinas, right, follows this, and Vittoria and Suarez, and, you know, and on and on and on. So what you say, or what you ask about is a, you know, phenomenal question. And it's, you know, it's animated, it's launched 1,000 essays, let's put it that way, right?
I'm almost 40 years old, and you know, I've been to Iraq and I've been in combat, an infantryman specifically engaged in combat. And what I, in just reading history, church history, I've always had a difficulty understanding the different standards, I guess, if you want to say, but I'm trying to get more clarification on it. As clerics, it seems like they of what you would call just war than the rest of the world is supposed to adhere to, meaning, you know, a priest who's being attacked by rebel forces in, let's say, Ghana or somewhere in Africa, they will not fight back because they are offering themselves up as a sacrifice, you know, martyrdom for the king, the kingdom of God. Where we are held to a different standard, not being clerics, to where we fight back and we engage in these battles. Almost me, who would you say is right? I mean, are we supposed to just stand by and be overrun and our lives taken as we offer them up to God? Are we all supposed to be martyrs in that sense? I guess that's my difficulty that I have with understanding the church's position, a just war, especially now that it's changed. You know, I've always felt that there was always a draw or always a calling for us to not engage in violence and engage in peace. But how do we do that? You know, like the gentleman who spoke earlier that's in ROTC, I've gone through ROTC. My wife has gone through ROTC. She's been to Iraq twice. I've been to Iraq once. And, you know, his role is going to be different if he is allowed to be a chaplain. He'll be a non-combatant. Whereas to my wife being an engineer and myself being an infantryman, we are required to fight for a cause that we may not believe in. You know, what we were told we were fighting for is not the trueness of what our foreign policy wants us to be there, engaging in combat. So I guess that's my problem in some of the things you're talking about. I don't know how to reconcile it with myself. I don't know, you know, like I don't want my children to want to be in the army and follow in our footsteps. I would rather them seek peace and love and justice, but not justice when it comes to taking lives. I mean, I don't know if that makes sense.
I think it does. There were a couple of times you broke up a little bit, Ricardo, at least for me on my end. I don't know if that was true for everybody, but look, there's a lot that you said, and it's very powerful. One of the points you were making was right, the sort of role responsibilities of those who are priests and religious and those who are not, right? And that the church in many different areas of our lives, right, recognizes there are duties and privileges that are associated with being in different roles in our faith, right? And those of us who are laity have certain kinds of privileges and responsibilities that are different than those who are not laity, right? And that is it's no surprise then that carries over even to thinking about the obligation that you might have as a lay person to defend not merely yourself, right, but you know your fellows in your battalion or whatever else, right? Whereas the priests and other chaplains in the military might have different responsibilities and different privileges as a consequence of that. So that was one component of what you said, but it seems like that was pointing towards at least a couple of the other points you were making, which was, wait a minute, if that calling is higher, why aren't we all supposed to embrace the higher calling, right? Why shouldn't we all embrace the higher calling here and be willing to do and even permitted to do what the priests are permitted to do and willing to do, right? And I take the force of your point. In some ways, it's not unrelated to Matthias's question right before you, you know, which is about what are Christians called? I make the claim, as you can tell, and I don't want to be coy about this, that to oppose peacemaking to the activity of a soldier in a conflict that abides this framework is a mistake. This being a soldier in a manner that abides this way of looking at things is itself or can be peacemaking. And I may be wrong about that, but that is my understanding what our church claims, that sometimes the defense of others out of love, and I think Pope Francis says this in Fratelli Tutti, sometimes the defense of others out of love requires us to be willing, not merely to lay down our own lives, because in some respects that's actually easier, right? Or at least it's notionally easier, than sometimes being willing to take the life of someone who threatens those people, you know? So partly what you're dealing with is, you know, is obviously personal, right? It's personal about you, your wife, and your children or future children. And I can't, of course, you know, solve, you know, the personal component of this for you. But I don't think the church has rejected the notion, and I don't think it will reject the notion, that the use of force can sometimes be an activity of love, an activity that is genuinely serving the common good.
Thank you.
Yeah, you, thank you.
Thanks for the great talk, Professor. I know this is probably far broader than the scope of like a 1 minute answer for question, but the Crusades generally, and there's a lot about them, you know, we hear a lot about them kind of to attack Christianity generally. I've only ever heard of it in a negative context really, but were any of the Crusades wars, or was some of them like unjust or just, what's the general kind of take on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think like the way I typically answer these kinds of questions is to say again, I don't like to approach this in that checklist manner, right? You know, did it do this? Did it do that? Right? You know, and so on. Was it just or unjust? Right? But what I typically do with students is I invite them to read the literature about the Crusades. And I think it's very important for Catholics to read that literature. There's really wonderful histories of the Crusades that have been written, especially over the past 40 years or so. some of them by non-Christian scholars. I mean, one of the most famous ones is by a Netanyahu, not the Netanyahu, but an historian with the same last name. I think actually he's related, but what you find there is obviously much more than the caricature, right? You find in these histories very sympathetic understandings of a couple of things. One is the fear that was felt by at least some of the citizens of Europe, right, about the threats, the military threats that were being posed in the Middle East, and you see even operative as a consequence of that fear, some of the notions that we were thinking about, right, the sense that there was a just cause here, that an unprovoked attack had led to the loss of land that Christians claimed for themselves, understood to be claimed for the Christian community. And that unprovoked attack required a response, right? And as it was a military attack, it required a military response. What is fascinating too about these accounts is that the people, there's a lot of evidence that the men, the Muslim men who were animated to embark on this conflict, you know, in these conflicts, were men of means, generally speaking. They were typically wealthy. They were typically men of deep faith, and they sacrificed a great deal, including in many cases their own lives, for the sake of this endeavor. So all I'm trying to do is add a little bit of color to, and maybe some nuance to, what we think of when we hear about the Crusades. Now, all that said, it's quite clear that from our perspective, none of us would think, and international law is, you know, is here with us on this, none of us would think that for a purely religious purpose, or what understands to be a kind of religious purpose, because there's a political purpose involved as well, that one could vindicate by force political problems or political injustice, excuse me, religious injustices, religious problems. That idea has largely been excluded from consideration from Christian reflection for a very, very long time, you know, since maybe roughly, you know, the 1600s or so. Maybe there's some disagreement about this now among the integralists. You know, you might see, if you guys are, you know, paying any attention to the integralist stuff, you may see some people who might say something different about that. But nowadays, the grounds for the vindication by force are really narrower than they once were. And the international law has specified those grounds, and the papacy has also narrowed those grounds over time. And generally speaking, it's understood as defense against ongoing aggression. Not even, in other words, vindication of something that's already happened, right? So if somebody, you know, takes Galway, right, you know, and the conflict is over, you know, and Galway is claimed by, let's say, Wales or something, you know, it's not clear that the Pope would say, oh, you could, you know, the Irish can vindicate Galway by means of force. The Pope would probably say, no, only by diplomacy or negotiation or something like that. Once the aggression has stopped, in other words, once the killing has stopped, we're all judging because of the conditions of modern warfare that one cannot vindicate these kinds of claims. I hope that helps a little bit. I do recommend that you look to some of the histories of the Crusades, because there's much more sophistication there than is, I think, typically the case. And you'll see, in some respects, parallels between the way the West, and again, the United States in particular, has prosecuted some of its own conflicts And in the ways that the Crusades operated, obviously one with a much more explicit religious language, the other one with a language that, while not explicitly religious, was very value-laden, right? Freedom being the obvious value that is often advanced on behalf of Western conflicts. And you'll see some really interesting parallels that might make you a little bit less judgmental about, or make us all a little bit less judgmental about past conflicts and a little bit more judgmental about our own conflicts. That makes sense?
Yep.
Another very good question. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
I just wanted to ask, if the priest is killed as a martyr because he's not willing to fight someone else, right? He's sacrificing himself. Obviously, that will not be held against him. So that will not be a sin for him in the afterlife. But as a lay person, if you do act in self-defense and you do kill someone, will that still be held against you as a sin? Because you did kill someone. Like, you might have had the right intentions of protecting someone else, but in the end, you still took a life.
Yeah, okay, Kinga. So assuming the conditions of your self-defense are the sorts of conditions that we've been describing, no, I mean, that is not sinful behavior. And that is the important distinction that this whole account is making, right? That there are different kinds of killing, right? There's killing that is murderous. And that's, you know, when you do something, out of some sinful intentionality, right? And you act to take somebody's life intentionally and so on. That would be murderous killing. And then there is killing that is not murderous. And that would be the killing that abides this account that we just described, where public authority has said, this fight is a just cause and it's for the purpose of vindicating the common good, of vindicating a community against some evil threat. In the case of self-defense, as you just described, it'd be quite similar to that. If somebody attacks you unjustly, and you defend yourself against that attack, and you take their life in the course of defending yourself, then that could be permissible, not, you know, unsinful behavior. You could also, of course, make the judgment that you will die at that person's hands, perhaps out of reasons of faith, right? It's not necessarily sinful.
Yes, Professor, sorry. Thank you for the talk. Can you hear me okay?
I can, perfectly.
Okay. I was just wondering in terms of Pope Francis's kind of views on war and weapons and so on and so forth, what is your opinion and take on that, and also on his Fratelli Tutti? I know you wrote kind of summarizing it yourself, but if you could summarize to us what you kind of, what were the key kind of points that we should address, or, and also, is it, should we also, I suppose he is the Pope, but should there be also changes now? Would you say there would be changes now in terms of how wars and in general troops and everything to go ahead from now on? Just what are your kind of thoughts on all that?
Thank you, Helen. Great question. So what we've seen in the church since Pope John the 23rd is a real concern about modern warfare, right? It's a concern that predates atomic and nuclear weapons, but it's also obviously exacerbated by the introduction of atomic and nuclear weapons, and perhaps also chemical and other kinds of weapons that are just of the sorts that were hardly conceived of in the past, right? So since the very early 20th century, when you had the introduction of airplanes and then the use of bombing, right? Bombing of cities, the nature of war, the popes are arguing, has changed. And it's become become directed against populations, right? Civilian populations. I think one can question that historically. Lots of wars were directed against civilian populations in the past. But there is something to be noted about the technological capacity, right, to wipe out tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in very, very little time, that the popes are rightly reflecting on. And you see a trend up to Pope Francis that is increasingly, in some ways, unwilling to find space for thinking of war as a good means of the vindication of justice, right? As we described it, as a kind of an expression of the political concern for justice. So I think that that's clear. On the other hand, right, and this is, I think, a point I make in the essay, although I didn't get the space there to sort of dwell on it, he doesn't move away from the idea that sometimes rights will be oppressed by somebody, and those rights need to be vindicated. And the examples that he uses, he refers to the Shoah, right, the Holocaust. I think maybe he refers to a couple of the genocides of the 20th century, the late 20th century. Sometimes the modes that were done to defend those or to even reverse them were the use of force. So it seems to me that he does seem to understand that the use of force in a sinful world remains necessary. One component of what he's doing, which I think is really clear, is he is moving away from states and their right to justify conflict, right? He obliquely refers to the United States' justification of its conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's deeply critical of it. And I think what you see him doing there is saying this needs to be turned over to the international community, right? This is another instance of something that from the papal perspective is better dealt with at the international level. And I think he's convinced that by doing this, it'll reduce recourse to war, that, and maybe even in particular by the United States, because they'll have given over the authority for determining cause and intentionality and so on to an international community. So I think that that's where the Catholic, the papacy at minimum, is pushing as we move forward. But I don't think he wants to retract what sometimes is called the right to protect. You may have heard of R2P doctrine, right, in international law. I have my own concerns about R2P, but I think he really wants to maintain that is still a live option, that force may be necessary in order to protect threatened communities. Okay, does that get to the different components of your question, Helen?
Yeah, thank you. Why do you not agree with the right to protect or have issues?
Yeah, lots of different reasons, I guess. I probably have a deeper suspicion of human good intentions, a suspicion that, to put it in another way, that the Pope has a good concern about state attempts to justify in their own names their own activity, right? And the hope is that international or regional authorities, you know, in other words, a kind of plurality of authorities will check against that self-justification, you know? And I think that sometimes is true, but I also think both in principle and practice, you see very often they end up just as nasty as individual states do, you know? So I just have my own suspicions about being too given over to the idea that regional or international organizations of power are less problematic than our, individual ones, you know? And then they become self-justifying. We know that the language of humanitarian intervention can become very quickly a kind of different way of justifying Western intervention in other societies, you know? So I worry the right to protect can do the same kinds of things. I'm suspicious of human beings, Helen. Let's put it that way, okay?
Me too.
There you go. We have something in common. Good. Well, thank you for your great question.